Well, hello everybody. Thanks for joining us again on Streamlines, your source for water knowledge. I'm your host, John McMain.
And hello, my name's Anthony Bly.
And this, Anthony, is episode 16.
Wow, I can hardly believe that.
Hasn't it been fun?
Yeah, it's been great.
And this is the second episode that we're talking about, phosphorus. So if you haven't listened to last week's episode introducing phosphorus, please go check that out as we continue to dive back into our phosphorus discussion. And last week, if you'll remember, if you listened to the podcast episode, we introduced you to Dr. Chad Penn. I'll let him reintroduce himself now.
My name's Chad Penn. I'm a soil scientist, a soil chemist for the USDA Agriculture Research Service, located at the National Soil Erosion Lab in West Lafayette, on campus at Purdue. I'm also an adjunct professor in the Department of Agronomy.
All right. So, and as I mentioned last week, I've known Chad for quite a while, first as my soil chemistry professor at Oklahoma State University when I was doing my PhD there. But we talked a little bit last week about tile drainage and phosphorus loss, and we didn't give Chad an opportunity to talk about that. So I'm gonna let him talk about that, as well as kind of talk about the kinetics. Again, we talked about variability and things like that last week too. But yeah, so let Chad talk about tile, phosphorus loss, variability, the chemical kinetics and things like that. So here's what he has to say on that.
It's so variable and we're trying to figure it out. So I'm doing a lot of work now in the lab using flow through. So normally, you know, for years I've been using flow through cells just for studying phosphorus adsorption to P-sorption materials. Now I'm using them to look at desorption on soils. And it is fascinating because the hydrology, the flow partly controls the kinetics. It does two things. It partly controls the kinetics of phosphorus loss and the soil to solution contact. And you can imagine, you know, how much impact that's going to have, not just on desorption, but adsorption. It gets more complicated. It's like, gosh, is it, if it isn't complicated enough, just looking at desorption from the topsoil. But with tiles, you got all this subsoil underneath it. That is this huge sink. I tell people all the time, you know, tiles get a bad rap. People think that putting in tiles, you know, it's Satan. Oh gosh, you put a tile drain in and you're polluting the world and you're destroying the lake. But I tell people, I'm like, man, I'd much rather have that water going straight down than I would running off, because I got 3 to 5 feet of a phosphorus removal structure that's 30 acres in area. That's the way I look at it, because that subsoil has a tremendous ability to absorb phosphorus. But sometimes it can fail at that depending on the hydrology. If it's not given the opportunity to absorb it, then it doesn't.
Yeah, soil is a filter.
Soil is a filter, especially for phosphorus.
Huge filter.
So in your experience as an agronomist and a soil scientist, would you say, I guess, what's been your experience of that? How far do you see phosphorus move through the soil profile? Does it usually stratify close to the top, or do you see it lower down?
Yeah, absolutely. It stratifies very easily. Okay. You can measure that in any soil profile.
Sure.
If it's had additions to the surface, you can pick that up. And even we think in our tillage systems that we're mixing it in, and we are, we're just stratifying it at a little deeper depth than if it just remained at the surface.
Gotcha. What about no-till systems?
Yeah, they're more stratified. There's no doubt about that. But we would hope that the healthier soil and the added mycorrhizae fungi and that would help, you know, the increased wetness of those soils would help those plants get it from the surface.
Sure. So they're, hopefully making it more bioavailable so you cycle it better into the plant.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
That makes sense. Do you see any movements with macropores, root channels, earthworm?
You know, I haven't noticed those as much in my sampling, but we have seen the movement from, you know, the 0 to 1 inch layer into the 1 to 2.
Okay.
I have some data that would support that.
Okay.
Gotcha. But it's very small, short distance.
Yeah. I'm impressed that
it moved that far.
Well, I'm impressed that you're doing that good a job of taking soil samples. Man, I struggle with that. It's like, anyway, that's another story.
Okay.
I guess I'm not a soil scientist.
Correct. That's okay. I'm not an engineer.
Well, so whenever we think about then phosphorus and tile, like like Chad said, I mean, generally we're decreasing the amount of phosphorus that leaves the field because we're filtering it
through the soil,
through the soil profile.
Mm-hmm. Right. Decreasing the erosion potential.
And that's historically, well, I mean, I guess now that's the majority of the phosphorus that leaves the system is through erosion.
Right.
So if we can control erosion, that goes a long way in reducing phosphorus loss. And tile does help reduce erosion. But then, yeah, the other aspect is thinking about soluble phosphorus. And so
that's why you asked me if I had any knowledge about it moving through the macro pores.
Right.
I do have knowledge, but it's from listening to somebody else talk about it.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. So, yeah, the scientific community.
Yep.
And then whenever we think about once it gets into the system, so, okay, let's say we, you know, have erosion, lose soil that contains phosphorus. Now it's in the water column. That's a really complicated piece that I had Chad try to explain to me. So this is what he had to say about that, is kind of the movement within the water column from soil to water and back.
So I've got a little bit of experience on that. Quite frankly, it's the same as soils. I mean, the sediments can act as a phosphorus source, or they can act as a sink and absorb more dissolved phosphorus, depending on the conditions. So obviously it's going to depend on the characteristics of the sediment itself. It's going to depend on how much phosphorus is on it currently, how saturated it is. It's going to depend on the pH of the solution, the water column that it's in, the lake or the ditch or whatever it's in. And it's going to depend on how much water it's in contact with. The soil to solution ratio partly controls whether that sediment is going to absorb more phosphorus from the solution or release it. And also its ability to contact the solution, you know, so think of like a flow rate, you know, how quickly that water's moving past, how long that water's in contact with the sediment is also going to have a big impact on, again, whether that sediment is going to release its phosphorus, whether it's going to absorb more dissolved phosphorus, or whether it's just going to do nothing at all and kind of stay in equilibrium. So it's dynamic.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
And I would say it makes it challenging to model because there's so many factors that affect it. And so when we think about water quality problems water quality issues, nutrient availability, we try to model how bad a problem would be. Well, there's all these different factors that are going to play into phosphorus.
All the different pools that it could be in.
Yeah.
And I'm not referring to water pools, but I mean partitions, should say.
Yeah, 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 right, exactly. Yep. The partitioning between soil to water.
Even in the soil, it's partitioned.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, to different components of the soil.
Right, available, unavailable.
Sure.
Yep. pH affects that. I mean, it can be in so many different places at one time, and it changes because of its, what I'm going to say, the environment. But, I mean, add water, take away water, change the pH of the water. You know, all those things. And it's just responding to all those dynamic changes.
So how would you say over a growing season that those partitionings or pools would change? Is that pretty dynamic within the growing season in a soil column?
Well, as the soil is taking up phosphorus, then the soil is releasing phosphorus.
Sure.
And you take that root away in the soil, go to a brown period without a living root, you're going to get more phosphorus that's starting to be fixed more and more.
Sure.
It's a slow migration from one partition to the other.
Yep. But it's probably pretty constant. I mean,
it's always happening, but we can, the direction is probably reversed because of that living root.
Gotcha. And so then, you take that to the water column and it's introducing a whole new set of conditions that all
correct
play into that.
Yep.
So one of the things we talked about last week, or introduced, I guess, was, and this was with the Lake Erie Basin, Western Lake Erie Basin, and the Toledo water crisis, and it was manure. And Chad, I asked Chad kind of what he saw, and started with a tile question, but it kind of moved into, if we've seen an increase in phosphorus loss or phosphorus loading, and then why he thought that was. So I'll let him talk about that, and then we'll get into, I think we'll have a nice discussion about this. So, but here's Chad.
With tiles particularly, You know, is the phosphorus lost in tiles negligible? No, it's not. But most of the time, it is negligible, at least dissolved P, even particulate P. You know, the sediment that you're losing in a tile, I'm sure you've seen this, it's highly variable throughout the year. You get some events where you lose large, you have large concentrations and very high loads. But if I had to choose between, on a given volume basis, of non-point water being lost in tiles versus non-point water being lost in runoff, surface runoff, I would much rather lose that water through a tile, because at the end of the day, I'd rather have the water moving through 3 to 5 feet of soil where, you know, it's effectively filtered very well. Another point I want to make about this is that I think in the past, if we go back a couple decades or more, dissolved P loss was negligible pretty much all the time. But currently, I'd say, okay, it's negligible 90% of the year. But then in like three events, it's no longer negligible and you're losing a huge amount. But I think in the past, decades ago, I think it was negligible. And it seems to me that there's two reasons why it is no longer negligible 100% of the time. One of those reasons is the advent of CAFOs. You know, there's nothing against CAFOs, it's just the nature of that system allows for soils to get built up high in phosphorus. So you've got sources. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a CAFO. You can build up a soil, you know, to be high in phosphorus, as you know, through chemical fertilizer or anything. You know, it doesn't have to be a CAFO. But those types of systems lend themselves to be built up in soil test phosphorus more easily compared to other systems. I think a second reason is because we no longer incorporate our fertilizer as it was decades ago. You know, because of the advent of no-till, but, you know, it's not just no-till. I mean, it's the no-till in addition to, in combination with a lack of incorporation. A lot of people like to just point the finger at no-till, but it's not that no-till is inherently bad for dissolved P loss. It's not. It's just that when you don't incorporate your fertilizer, when you don't allow for that fertilizer-to-soil contact interaction, then you end up having a large load soon after the first event that occurs after application. So, you know, like 15 years ago, you could apply all your annual phosphorus while planting all in the same pass, but the planters were much smaller. There were more like 12 row planters at that time. They're much bigger now, right? And so now we can only apply enough phosphorus at planting for starter fertilizer, starter phosphorus. That's not enough for annual or 2 or 3 year applications. So instead, alternatively, they'll broadcast phosphorus instead of applying it all up planting. All right, well, now it's broadcasted, it's on the surface. So then you'd have to make another pass to incorporate that. So I think it's kind of the nature of the business right now, and the nature of the machinery and how it's developed over the years. But quite frankly, I know it sounds simple, everybody knows this. This isn't revolutionary, but, you know, if we can apply our phosphorus more than just starter fertilizer, but, you know, our normal annual or applications and what we'd apply for two or three applications, if we can apply that at once and incorporate it at the same time, that would reduce the loads tremendously. Some of that is just my opinion, you know, because quite frankly, we just don't know. But if you look at the nature of how things have changed, especially within the Western Basin with time, like when did the concentration start going up of dissolved P? And if you look at all the other things that were happening at that time, all of that was happening at once, you know, the advent of CAFOs, no-till coming on, and then application of phosphorus being broadcasted and not incorporated. Other than that, because soil test P values, for the most part, they're not really increasing in the Western Basin, you know, with the exception of some around some CAFOs.
So there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, especially the talking about incorporating fertilizer. And, you know, we can still inject it and not do any tillage.
Sure.
That is a possibility.
Yep.
Just wanted to point that out.
Let's start there.
Okay.
So, yeah, what do you think about that? Do you think, you know, broadcasting versus injection or incorporation, is that a significant issue for P loss in your opinion?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, you know, if you're incorporating it, you're not doing no-till anymore.
Right.
So, but if you're injecting it, you can do that and still, you know, practice the no-till.
Is there a happy medium of some amount of incorporation with reduced tillage?
Yeah, there could be. It's still at the surface.
Okay.
And like I said before, we're still stratifying it. It's just at a little deeper depth than if we just leave it at the surface.
Okay.
You know, so like a mulch till operation, it isn't going to incorporate it.
Sure.
You know, past 1 to 2 inches.
Sure.
So it's still there at the surface.
Yeah. But I guess
higher concentration.
So if we look at the continuum of getting phosphorus into the subsoil is maybe not the right word because if it's only the top 3 inches, that's not subsoil, that's still topsoil.
No, that's topsoil.
But if we get it deeper in the topsoil, we'll say, with incorporation, well, now we're more at risk of erosion.
Correct.
So I guess
it's kind of a balance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we want to reduce the erosion or minimize the erosion, eliminate the erosion ideally, but at the same time get some incorporation. So let's think about injection.
Banding.
So, banding, okay.
Correct.
So let's talk through that.
Well, I mean, that's another pass because, like he mentioned, you know, a lot of producers are not going to carry that amount of fertilizer during planting. It's just too much.
Sure.
So it's another trip across the field. It's another operation.
Sure.
Takes time.
Yeah.
Good field conditions. So I know the strip tillers, I think, are using that as their nutrient application pass.
Okay.
And at the same time, it's tilling a strip, and that's why it's called strip till.
Sure.
But so that's getting into the soil.
What benefits of no-till do we lose if we do that?
Well, I mean, we're disrupting that soil in that zone where we're doing that. The macropores are disrupted. We may be decreasing water infiltration in that zone, and we've seen that in some cases. We've seen erosion happen in that strip till path.
Okay.
You know, then you need to address that with the direction you're making your strips.
Okay.
And actually, you're planting your field when you're making those strips.
Sure.
So you have to pay attention to that when you're doing that strip till process.
Gotcha.
Because you're actually planting your field. You're not doing the seeds, but you're going to come back at some point and plant that with that pattern.
That is your...
Yeah, okay. That's your planting pass.
So then if we think about banding, so not incorporation. Well, yeah, I guess it is incorporation. And then if we
go... It's injecting. To me, incorporation is a different pass that mixes the fertilizer into the soil.
Okay.
Where injecting or banding it, the fertilizer is put on in that process.
Okay.
And it's put into the soil.
Yep. So then, yeah, again, I guess it goes back to balance of reducing erosion, but getting it deeper in the topsoil.
Correct. Layer.
Okay.
Correct. Protecting it.
Protecting it, sure. Mm-hmm. So let's move then to another point of Chad's of the advent of CAFOs. And just to define CAFO for folks that don't know, concentrated animal feeding operation in South Dakota, state of South Dakota, that's a permitted facility that has 1,000 animal units or more, and all CAFOs are required to go through a livestock environmental training, which Anthony and I both participate in.
Right.
Yep. A couple talks on that. And so thinking about CAFOs, and this is also going back to a comment you made in the first episode about phosphorus, about manure.
Yes.
And how we view manure, and the particular term that you took umbrage with was the word disposal.
Yeah, it's no longer disposal activity.
Yeah.
We need to treat it as a commodity.
Sure.
It has value. And we can calculate that value.
Sure.
And use it as such.
Yeah. And so with a CAFO, so if you look at it, I guess a really small watershed, which would be, you know, an animal operation with maybe however many fields around that.
Right.
There's usually somewhat of an imbalance of the nutrients that come in and feed. It's usually not 100% from, you know, the fields that then the manure goes back onto.
Right. It's a concentration.
I guess it's in the name. concentration. So, and then if we look at the watershed scale, that's what's happened in, say, Chesapeake Bay.
Correct.
So we have a situation in Chesapeake Bay of grain comes in from Midwest or some other watershed
on a train.
Yeah.
Train or truck.
And gets fed to animals. Some of those nutrients gets converted into
meat
or eggs or
milk.
Jinx.
Food.
Yeah.
Food.
And then some of that is not converted. I don't
yeah, it's not 100% efficient process.
Right.
It's just not going to be. It's biological.
Yeah. And so then that's what is in the manure, those excess nutrients.
Correct.
So then, but then the issue.
That manure doesn't come back from where the grain came from.
Right.
Yes.
So then we end up with an imbalance around that livestock operation.
A nutrient imbalance.
Yeah. So what can we do about that?
Well, we can try to put the manure back where the grain came from. A better distribution plan.
What if we distributed the animals more?
Oh yeah, that would work, yeah. But the industry's not going that direction.
Yeah, this is true.
Yeah.
And I guess we see kind of more concentration of concentrated animal feeding operations in certain areas, certain parts of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Less and less folks want to do the animal husbandry, the raising of animals anymore. And so we've learned to concentrate them.
Sure.
And to be more efficient. And, you know, we're doing a better job as well. You know, you can look at the efficiencies of those operations.
Yeah. Okay, so if those remain concentrated, how do we get nutrients out of the watershed?
Well, we have to truck them out, just like the grain was trucked in. It's a nutrient balancing act. That's all we're doing is hauling nutrients around.
Is there any technology? I mean, I know so like for dairies, there's some technologies for actual nutrient partitioning, nutrient concentration. So, you know, I mean, you could dry out the manure, get it into a concentrated form or concentrate it in a liquid form. Think that has any promise?
Sure. Composting is really concentrating those nutrients in a medium or a product.
Sure.
So you don't have to haul as much.
Right.
Or transport as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But bottom line.
That costs money.
Oh, yeah, that costs money. That's true.
Lots of money.
But, you know, nutrient imbalance and watershed costs money too.
Yeah, it's costing everybody money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to figure out a way to transfer that cost to people.
To pay for it. So, mm-hmm.
So I talk about wild and crazy things like manure trains or manure pipelines, but it's really to get everybody's attention to the fact that we need to transport this commodity, which is a waste to lots of people, because we've heard that discussion, but it's a commodity, to get it back to where that grain came from in the first place.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it comes down to balance. And like I think you or Chad or Lindsay said that it's, well, maybe multiples. I mean, you said that it definitely has value. And then and we can quantify that. And if we compared, you know, the nutrient content to commercial fertilizer, well, we would purchase some amount of N to put on the field.
Correct. Or we might not. I mean, we can test all these things, and right. We know what we have. We know what we're working with.
Yeah. And if we think about a water quality perspective, what's in manure in and of itself isn't inherently bad, although E. coli, fecal coliforms, things like that would you know, be considered inherently bad for human health.
Sure.
But the nutrients, not so much. The issue is the imbalance.
Right. Nutrient imbalance. Getting those nutrients back to where that grain came from in the first place.
Okay. So I actually asked Chad kind of about soil test pee and things like that. And whenever we think about imbalance of nutrients, typically it is a phosphorus issue.
Yes.
I mean, typically, well, I don't know. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Typically, we don't worry about that for nitrogen. Is that right?
Right.
Because nitrogen can move, and we don't want it to move downward. To be lost, leached, but it can be
it moves with the water more efficiently.
Yeah.
Yeah, more readily.
Whereas phosphorus can build up until then, now you got this ticking time bomb of, you know,
correct.
Leaching pee or losing mm-hmm. pee with erosion.
Yep, it's a bad deal.
So phosphorus is the main one we worry about building up more than nitrogen and other other nutrients. And one of the things I asked Chad about was if there is information available on kind of where our hot spots are, where are the risky areas, where do we really have to worry about? And basically, that is not widely available. It's not really publicly available. I mean, because that's sensitive information. But anyway, this is what he had to say. And I think kind of coupling his discussion with what you're thinking about with kind of redistribution, I don't know, there's some potential there. So this is what Chad had to say about that.
You know, a lot of it, it's private information. You know, that said, you can get some idea of distribution through working with the soil testing labs. You know, oftentimes they'll cooperate and, you know, they won't give you, you know, names and addresses, but sometimes they'll release soil test values for a county. And so you'll have a whole collection of soil test P values for an entire county. And so, you know, potentially you can get that. You know, other than that, sometimes working through farmers that are enrolled in certain NRCS programs, or I'll give you another example, CAFOs, you know, they have to report it. So, you know, that information can often be obtained, although it's not easy, but, you know, they're required to do testing on an annual basis and report it to, you know, certain state agencies. But if we knew that, if we knew exactly, if we knew with soil test P distribution, you know, throughout entire states, it would make it a lot easier to target certain conservation practices. And that's one of the biggest issues. I have to say, well, this is kind of a theory of mine. It's based on logic and it's based on certain facts, but it's not proven. Well, one of the reasons why is because I have to say that is because we don't know all these things for absolute true, because we don't have this data that you're suggesting. We as simple as it is. Let's just look at soil test P distribution, you know, but, you know, we don't necessarily know. We can get it on a county basis, but even then, you know, oftentimes people that participate in these sorts of volunteer programs are often they're the best producers.
Sure.
So they're doing a good job of nutrient management. And so their soil test P values are going to be, you know, not excessive.
I agree.
We just don't have the information to target our efforts that well.
Yeah. Do you think that would ever be something people would be willing to share or participate in, things like that?
I don't know. For the right price, maybe, but that there's a vulnerability issue there. There's a trust issue there, and yeah, there's lots of problems with that.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about in the livestock environmental training is the makeup. It's like soybeans, fixed nitrogen, High protein,
yep.
And then
big end user.
Right. And so that, I don't know, that's always interesting to me to think about what specifically that element is going to do either in the plant or then in the animal or us or whatever.
Correct. Right.
So, yeah, nitrogen.
Proteins.
Yep. And amino right. acids and then proteins.
Yep. Yep. Structures.
Yeah.
Right.
And so
phosphorus
then, and that's going back to your ATP and
bones.
Okay, bones. Bones are important.
Lots of reasons for a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's kind of, I don't know, kind of cool for me to think about. Not that I do anything with it. One interesting thing, my wife is a dietitian by training, and she works with dialysis patients. And believe it or not, phosphorus is one of the biggest things they track for dialysis patients.
Really?
Because of the same chemistry that it will actually start to pull calcium out of the bones. And
sure.
And because, you know, with limited kidney function, the body is not capable or doesn't do as efficient job of cycling that phosphorus out, and then dialysis is inefficient. And so you have to minimize the phosphorus intake you have because, yeah, it starts to pull other stuff because of the chemical makeup of phosphorus.
Right.
And anyway, I always thought that was interesting. It's an issue for dialysis patients and dietitians, and it's an issue for water quality specialists and soil scientists.
Environment.
And,
right. Yeah. Too much in the wrong place is a bad deal.
Too much of a good thing is no longer a good thing.
And you, when you need it, you need it, and you know
yeah.
it. Yeah. Yeah. It's a nutrient that, You know, it's all over the planet, but in the right form, in the right place, like in a mine, in a phosphorus mine, we can find those places, mine it out. We can make fertilizer out of it and put it on.
And I want to, now that you brought up the mining thing, that struck a thought. So thinking back to concentrations and the distribution. So we start concentrated in a mine. We go to the field and distribute it into the field kind of at a low, so high concentration to low concentration. And this is both kind of
correct. You
know, milligrams per liter as well as kind of a landscape scale.
Right.
And then once we have gotten the grain, we reconcentrate it in the grain, and then we really concentrate it in the animal and in the manure.
Right.
So then you need to really redistribute that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the whole story.
Manure pipeline.
Manure pipeline. I think they're going to happen.
Okay.
I really do. I'm confident in that.
Yeah. Well, right. you let me know when the
first one goes in.
Yeah. IPO is, and I'll think about investing in that.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop for today. So again, phosphorus, it's a tricky issue when it comes to water quality, but there are some solutions we have for phosphorus removal. So the next two episodes, we're going to talk about phosphorus removal structures, kind of their design, their performance. And then the last episode for phosphorus, we're going to talk about the future and kind of where we go from here. So if you like anything you heard today on Streamlines, be sure to check us out on the SDSU Extension webpage for more information. Or follow me on Twitter at SDSUEXTWaterman. And for now, I'm John McMain.
And I'm Anthony Bly.
And we'll talk to you again soon.